So first of all, why do nations trade? I mean, America is a big country. We're richly endowed with many natural resources. So why trade with other nations? Yeah, I mean, even though we're a big country and even though we are naturally endowed with many natural resources, we don't have everything that we need. Or at least it would be very expensive if we were to try to have everything we need without trading with other nations, right? Like, you know, for example, if you're a coffee drinker and you say, well, let's grow our own coffee, but not trade with other nations, then we might have to build big greenhouses. And so maybe a pound of coffee would be priced at maybe $35-$40. So it's better to let another country, because the fact is here is that the world's resources are not evenly distributed around the globe. And so let's let another country that where their environment and their resources, their soil, their topography, I mean, there's a lot involved here. Let them grow coffee, and then we can buy coffee from them at a whole lot less than if we were to grow it ourselves. So this is why nations trade with one another, because now could we survive if we did not trade with other nations? Yeah, I mean, if you're just talking about survival, I think we would survive. But I mean, could we live as well in terms of our standard of living if we did not trade with other nations? And the answer to that is definitely not. In order to have the high standard of living that we do, we have to trade with other nations. Okay, so let's see. Let me do this here instead. I can see the bigger picture here. And of course, which two countries do we trade most with? Two countries we trade most with is Canada and Mexico, our two closest neighbors. Now, if we're going to trade with other nations, we've learned that it is good to specialize. I mean, this is an economic concept, right? This is what Henry Ford did with the assembly line. Instead of having a skilled craftsman technique where you had two or three skilled craftsmen assembling a whole automobile, what did Henry Ford do? He came up with the assembly line, which meant that instead of using skilled craftsman technique production, you'd have many workers, but each worker would do what? Each worker would specialize, right? Each worker would have a simple task. And we learned, why this assembly line increased productivity. In fact, when Adam Smith wrote his book, The Wealth of Nations, way back in 1776, describing how a free market system works, the first thing he talked about was a division of labor, and how when you divide up the labor, you can greatly increase productivity. And with an increase in productivity, since we can produce more at lower costs, we can sell at lower prices, this increases buying power, this increases growth, increases people's standard of living. Now, if you think about the assembly line, how does this relate to trade? Well, if you look at countries as, like people on the assembly line, and we're looking at all countries around the world, and we're saying, well, now, instead of each, countries doing their own thing, maybe countries should specialize in certain things and then trade with other nations. So if we could divide up the labor, see what I mean? Just like with the assembly line, if we could divide up the labor, and every country would specialize in one, a handful, or it depends on the country, but by dividing up the labor and then trade, then everyone would benefit due to the increase in productivity. So then the question becomes, all right, if we're going to divide up the labor, if we're going to have you know, countries specializing, what should countries specialize in? And what's the answer to that? Yes, the key there, the key word there, term, is comparative advantage. What should countries specialize in? If we're going to divide up the labor and then trade, what should countries specialize in? Those things that they have a comparative advantage in. Now, what does that mean?
Whatever they have the lowest opportunity cost.
Opportunity cost is the key here, yes. A comparative advantage says that we're gonna specialize in those things whereby we have low opportunity cost. Now, what's opportunity cost? Yeah, right. That thing foregone. You know, that what you give up because you're doing what you're doing instead of something else. Opportunity cost is that what you give up in the best alternative endeavor. So the example I gave, you know, and with the original lecture here was, you know, true or false. In order for a country to maximize their welfare, it ought to produce those things that it is best at producing. True or false? False. Why? I mean, it certainly sounds like it should be true. I mean, why shouldn't a country, specialize in those things that they are best at doing? I mean, what's wrong with that way of thinking? Now, if you do something better than someone else, what do you call that? That's not comparative advantage. That's called what?
Absolute.
Absolute advantage. That's right. Absolute advantage. That says that, you know, absolutely you have an advantage in this one thing. So I mean, if that statement were true, you know, if I were to say, okay, you know, every country ought to specialize in those things that they are best at doing, then those things that they are best at doing would be those things that they have an absolute advantage in. But we just said that countries aren't going to trade based on absolute advantage. They're going to trade based on comparative advantage. Now, the extreme example I gave was, all right, so what happens if Americans were better than anyone else manufacturing handmade wicker baskets? I mean, let's say, you know, we can do that better. All right, we've got an absolute advantage. You know, we can do it, you know, faster. We can do it with fewer resources. And for some reason, Americans are great at making these wicker baskets. So we have an absolute advantage in making wicker baskets. Well, does that mean we'll devote our time and energy to make wicker baskets? Because if we were to devote our time to wicker baskets, what's our opportunity cost? I mean, an hour spent making a wicker basket is an hour spent that we can't do things like
make computers?
Yeah, maybe somewhere in the computer field. I mean, you know, you can't be doing two different things at the same time. I mean, you know, because we're highly advanced, we're industrialized, you know, high level of education, high level of skill, I mean, you know, maybe, you know, we could get a better return devoting our time to, you know, something in the high-tech field, like computers. See, if we devote our time to wicker baskets, is our opportunity cost high or low? Very high, see? So that's why we shouldn't do it. Our opportunity costs are high. Now, if we devote our time and energy to making computers or something, you know, doing something in the high-tech field, well, then what's our opportunity cost? Well, then we can't do, you know, something else that's going to be nearly as marketable, you know, as profitable. So our opportunity cost is very low if you consider spending, you know, time in the high-tech field. So that's why we say that if we devote our time to the high-tech field, since our opportunity costs are low, this is something that we might, you know, have a comparative advantage in. Okay? So every country ought to devote their time and energy to making those things that they have a comparative advantage in and then trading. I mean, let another nation make the wicker baskets. Okay, you know, maybe they can't do it as good as we can, but can they do, I mean, is good enough good enough? I mean, if good enough is good enough, let them make the wicker baskets, let us make the computers, and then trade, and both countries will be better off. Yeah.
At some point, we were talking about the benefits of diversifying.
Mm-hmm.
So countries are aiming to balance between diversifying and specialization. Is that?
Well, that is. I mean, when you specialize, your diversification was an argument for trade restrictions. That's when we're talking about diversification. You know, we're saying that a country should not be dependent on one or a handful of exports. So one way of fostering the development of you know certain industries, is to subsidize, or in the different ways we can do it. But the whole point is to diversify, so we're not dependent upon you know, the markets, the ups and downs of the market of just a handful of products. See that? But for, you know, a country like the United States, you know, that, I mean, we're already very diversified. So, I mean, you know, you couldn't use a diversification argument to limit trade or, you know, to restrict trade. I mean, you know, we're already very diversified. But, you know, a smaller country maybe that, you know, is dependent, you know, that it's always feast or famine, depending upon how a few markets do over the years, then, you know, maybe they should have some trade restrictions to foster more diversification. That's how we got into diversification. See, what we're saying here is, we're saying that everything else being equal, free trade is best. And if you accept the premise of free trade is best, then it follows that every country should specialize in those things that they have a comparative advantage in, and then trade freely with other countries. But then later we learn, well, now, you know, maybe there are times when there may be some good reasons for trade restrictions. Of course, there are a lot of bad reasons for trade restrictions too. But you know, we'll talk about that, and I'll go over those things here in just a few minutes. What makes differences in countries? I mean, you know, why would one country have a comparative advantage in something over another country? Well, there's several categories of reasons. One category would be the infrastructure. Right, infrastructure. Now, what's infrastructure? Well, infrastructure is communication, the road system, the electrical system. The better the infrastructure is, you know, the more advanced the communication system, the better the roads are, productive we can be, and so some countries have got a very good infrastructure, and other countries got a very poor infrastructure, and that that determines what kinds of things that might be best at producing. Another category is capital. You know, some countries are very capital intensive, like the United States. Capital, of course, meaning machines or tools. Other countries, you know, may have small amounts of capital, and therefore maybe they have to rely on labor, labor-intensive type, production. So how much capital a country has is a major factor. A third major factor, you know, that would differentiate one country from another would be its level of education. you know, how educated is, you know, the average worker? Of course, here, you know, we're talking about people in general, and we're talking about the workforce, and then if they are educated, what kind of education do they primarily have? So that determines, you know, what a country's going to produce. You know, here in America, we we're reliant on foreigners for some of our some areas, like scientists, for example. Science is, I mean, if we, you know, if we didn't bring foreigners into America, we would be very limited what we can do in terms of science, because just a lot of American students, you know, don't go into those type, you know, science type fields. If we didn't, you know, I mean, if we had trade restrictions, or if we didn't, you know, let a lot of these foreigners come in that have certain skills, well, we would be limited in a lot of the things that we can do, like, you know, research. Skills, of course, is related to education. That's a fourth category. Skills is having the skill to operate big machines or things like that. And then the last one is really quite important, but it's attitude. Attitude. You know, people's attitudes can differ from country to country. You know, there's something called a work ethic. And, you know, maybe, you know, people in one country have a good work ethic, and maybe another country, you know, maybe they don't have a good work ethic. And so, these are factors in what we should produce in order to trade. Well, now what we can talk about are trade restrictions. And what we're going to talk about is the good ideas and bad ideas in terms of trade restrictions. Why do we restrict trade? But before we talk about that, we can talk about how we restrict trade. So how do we restrict trade? Well, one way is through tariffs. Now, what's a tariff? A tariff is a tax on an import. Another way to restrict trade is quotas. Now, what's a quota? Well, quota says you can import this product, but only up to so many units. That's a quota. Now, of course, what do tariffs and quotas do to the price? Yeah, see, I mean, this is a, you know, when a foreign company has to pay this tariff, for example, that's an added cost, and that cost would be reflected in the higher price. Now, for quotas, anytime you restrict the supply of something, what happens to the price? It goes up. See, I mean, without the quotas, we would have a larger supply. So prices would be lower, but with quotas, we're limiting the supply, so that tends to make prices higher. So both these, you know, for different reasons, both these things lead to higher prices. Well, another way to restrict trade would be subsidies. Now, this isn't quite as cut and dry, but when a country subsidizes, like the example I gave earlier, is that let's say maybe the French government will subsidize French steel companies and say, okay, for every ton of steel you export, we'll give you X, you know, amount of money. And so that's a subsidy. Now, why is this a restriction of trade? Well, it's a restriction of trade because it's an example of unfair competition. I mean, you know, maybe without these subsidies, an American company could compete quite well with a French company. But the playing field is no longer level if the French company is subsidized and the American company is not. In fact, maybe the French company can sell steel for less than their costs and therefore greatly underprice the American company, but the French company can still make a profit because of the subsidy by their government. See, and that's just unfair. But it's, you know, so, I mean, it is a way of restricting trade when countries subsidize. Another way to restrict trade is licensing agreements. You know, that says, okay, you know, you can import into our country, but before you import, you have to get a license. Now, in order for you to get a license, you have to meet, you know, these requirements. And, of course, we can write anything in there that we want. So, you know, that's the way of restricting trade. And the last way that we can restrict trade is on unreasonable standards, like safety standards, saying, okay, you know, you can import cars into America, but you have to meet these certain safety requirements. And maybe those safety requirements are just, you know, unreasonable. So maybe a foreign car maker will say, well, I mean, we'd be glad to import this car because it's a good seller in our country, but, I mean, it's not worth it to us to make these major adjustments, you know, to meet these, what we feel are unreasonable safety standards. And so we're not going to import into your country. And, or export to a country, which would be an import of the receiving a country. Okay, let's see. Now, different countries have all kinds of restrictions, and what are some arguments for trade restrictions? Now, some of these arguments are good and some are not so good. One argument is national defense. Take Israel, for example. Maybe Israel does not have a comparative advantage in making guns and ammunition, and maybe economically they should import those things from other nations. But that would not be a good idea. I mean, if Israel was dependent upon foreigners for their war material, and since it's surrounded by enemies, it would be very easy for their enemies to cut off, you know, this foreign supply of this war material, and that would limit Israel's, the time factor in terms of waging war. And so would it be a good idea for Israel to put tariffs and quotas and other restrictions maybe against certain war items so that even though they don't have a comparative advantage in these things, they would still be independent, they would make these things at home, so they would not have to import them from other nations. And that, you know, that makes sense. That, you know, in some cases, that's a very good argument for trade restrictions. Another argument is protect infant industries. I mean, just like children, you know, they're born and they're babies and then they become toddlers. I mean, you know, there's no way that they can go out into the world and fend for themselves. And maybe, you know, it's a good idea for the family, you know, to support them and to take care of these, you know, babies until they grow up and become adults and... If we did it right, then, you know, they can be independent and support themselves. Well, you know, might not the same thing be true for companies? You know, maybe a country has the resources that, you know, that are desirable for maybe, you know, a certain type of product or, you know, industry. But maybe because, you know, we don't have a history of that, and other countries do, it's just hard for us to start from scratch and compete with these well-established, you know, companies in other countries. Well, I mean, if we do have resources that are very desirable for a certain product, maybe, or a certain industry, then maybe we ought to protect, you know, companies in that industry to promote them to grow, and then later on, when they're big and they can compete on a level playing field with these foreign companies, then maybe we could lift the restriction. And in some cases, you know, that's a good argument too. especially for a country that's, you know, a developing country. Another argument for trade restrictions is to protect us against predatory dumping. Now, what is predatory dumping? Well, I mean, economically, I mean, let's say that, you know, we all here represent different companies, but let's say that you are much larger than the rest of us, and you're more well-established than the rest of us, and you have what are called deep pockets. How can you eliminate us as competitors? Huh? What can you do to eliminate the rest of us as competitors? You're well established. You've got deep pockets, a lot deeper than we do. Yeah. In fact, would you maybe cut your prices even lower than your costs? Maybe. And if you do, could the rest of us compete? No. I mean, we don't have now. Why can you hold out longer than we can at these, you know, at these very low prices? Well, because you've got deep pockets. You know, you've got reserves that we don't. So you just hang on, and you'll make a loss for a while. But meanwhile, you know, we'll go out of business. And then once we go out of business, well, then now you've gained market share. And now you can raise your price and make a whole lot more money. You see, now that's what predatory dumping is all about. You know, big companies taking advantage of little companies by making their price unreasonably low for the purpose of driving the smaller companies out of the market. Well, now if that is occurring, you know, let's say there's a foreign a company and they're importing at unreasonably low prices because they are trying to drive some American companies out of business. Would it not be a good idea for the American government to put tariffs up against, you know, those products to raise the price maybe back up to where they would be if it were not, you know, for this, in order to level out the playing field? And yeah, you know, I mean, theoretically, in that situation, that would be a good argument. Of course, in all of these arguments, it's, you know, what is fact and what is fantasy? Okay, is this foreign company charging these low prices because they're predators and they're trying to drive American companies out of business, or is it just market forces that are, you know, dictating the lower prices? Or maybe they're able to, you know, to sell for lower prices because, you know, they've increased productivity. Maybe, you know, maybe they just, things have worked out to where they just, have got the market advantages. You know, they've got, I mean, they're good, economic, reasons. See? So that's, you know, in all these arguments, you got to be, I mean, even the good arguments, you still got to be a little careful. I mean, even the national defense argument, I mean, you know, how far do you go with that? I mean, you know, what is really necessary, you know, during wartime? And all these things, you know, one has to make, you know, a judgment. And there's always room for being unreasonable. Okay, another reason for trade restrictions is to protect temporary declining, the next one is to reduce unemployment. In other words, this is what the Smoot-Hawley tariff was, right, and all about in 1930. I mean, why did Congress pass the Smoot-Hawley tariff in 1930? Because they were thinking, well, now if we make foreign products more expensive, especially relative to American-made products, Americans will buy more American-made products, and this will mean more American jobs. Now, if you don't know a whole lot about economics, that kind of sounds, oh, yeah, well, that sounds good. But if you understand the bigger picture and you understand how economics works, just the opposite is true, right? Because when you, this is the weakest argument of all. I mean, and of all the arguments for trade restrictions, this is the weakest one. I mean, if we're going to put tariffs up against foreign products for the sole reason of protecting American jobs, that's a poor argument. I mean, it's a poor argument because it leads to the opposite. Instead of helping Americans, you hurt Americans. When you put tariffs up against, that's what the Smoot-Hawley tariff did in 1930. It simply raised almost all prices, which decreased buying power, which decreased consumer demand, which made the unemployment problem worse. Remember, there were three reasons for the Great Depression, right? Three policy mistakes. The Smoot-Hawley tariff, 1930, decrease in the money supply in 1931 and in 1932, and increasing taxes in 1932. Those three policies is what led to the Depression. Okay, the next argument for trade restrictions would be protect temporary declining industries. And, maybe this has some validity to it. But again, you got to be careful. You know, maybe we have a viable industry here. You know, this is what we did with Chrysler in the automobile industry once. You know, I mean, Chrysler, we came on some very hard times for different reasons. And we said, well, okay, we don't want to lose a key participant here in this automobile industry. And Chrysler, you've got a good track record. And we feel that, we need you as part of this country. And so we're going to help you temporarily. We're going to put trade restrictions, so that you can compete better. And then after a certain time, we're going to lift these restrictions because we're just going to help you temporarily, just so you don't, disappear from the playing field. Yeah, okay, maybe. It depends on the situation. It depends on, why the business is coming on hard times. There's a lot of factors here, but, this could be a good argument for trade restrictions. All right, the last argument for trade restrictions is to promote variety. And this is what I was talking about earlier, where, diversification, if a country's dependent upon one or just, a handful of exports, maybe they ought to put trade restrictions to promote other industries so that they will have a wide variety of exports instead of just a handful. And that way they can protect themselves from this feast or famine type boom and bust cycle. And that makes sense. Now, not for the United States, because we're already very diversified. For a small developing country under certain circumstances, maybe it's a good argument. Okay, what are arguments against trade restrictions? One argument is that it leads to a retaliation. I mean, if there's anything you've ever learned about here in economics, it's, whatever goes around comes around, right? Whatever goes around comes around. Whatever it is we give out, that's what we get back. And this is certainly true with trade restrictions. I mean, especially let's say that, that we put tariffs up against foreign products to protect American jobs. Well, what we're trying to do here, and, what the Smoot-Hawley tariff did in 1930 is that our Congress said, hey, we've got an unemployment problem, but we don't want this problem, so we're going to try to give it to somebody else by putting, high protective tariff up against, their imports. And, well, of course, what happens then, lots of things come into play here. I mean, for one, if we buy less from them, then they've got less money to buy from us. So if they buy less from us, then that leads to a loss of American jobs. Now, and that's particularly true if this leads to a tariff war. A tariff war says, all right, you put tariff against us to protect your jobs, So we're going to put tariffs up against your products to protect our jobs. And so now you've got a war. Well, you know, it's a tit for tat. Okay, you did this, and we'll do this. And, oh, well, you did that, and we'll do this. And next thing you know, we got these, you know, tariffs. I mean, it's tariffs going up all over the place. Now, who wins a tariff war? Nobody wins a tariff war. Everybody loses. I mean, that's a surety. I mean, nobody has ever won a tariff war. Every country loses because of the higher prices in all countries and slower growth. So that's called retaliation. You know, okay, you did it to us, so we'll do it to you. Another argument against trade restrictions is that if you're not careful, trade restrictions can subsidize weakness. I mean, if we subsidize companies and, you know, and if the only time they can compete is because of the subsidy, and we keep subsidizing them, then all we're doing is we're subsidizing weakness. And that's particularly not good because what you really gotta catch hold of is, you know, we don't live in a world onto our own. I mean, you know, this is what this chapter's all about. We're very much tied in with the rest of the world. You know, that America, there's only one nation in the world that has a higher capital gains tax than America, and that's Japan. We have, you know, America has one of the highest, it's the second highest capital gains tax. Now, that is a big discouragement for investors. You know, it's a big negative when someone says, hey, I want to make an investment, but I'm going to have to take a risk. A capital gains tax stifles investment. You know, Ireland used to have a very high capital gains tax, and they cut their capital gains tax down to next to zero. And what do you suppose happened in Ireland? What's Ireland? You know where Ireland is today? Economically, one of the fastest growing economies in the world. I mean, Ireland is booming economically. And a big part of it is because they lowered their taxes, especially taxes on capital. Another argument against trade restrictions is it works against comparative advantage. If all countries are going to trade according to comparative advantage, then we've got all these trade restrictions, then, you know, now what we've got is, you know, a bunch of countries, you know, producing things that they don't have a comparative advantage in. And that's bad for everybody. You know, it just leads to slower growth and a slower standard of living, a lower standard of living. Another argument against trade restrictions is that there's problems with, policing and enforcing. We're a big country and we've got big borders. And, as soon as we start putting trade restrictions, we gotta, you know, enforce all these laws. And that can become very cumbersome. And lastly, another argument against trade restrictions is that it encourages rent seeking. Now, what is rent seeking? What does that term mean? Like, I was listening to a news program over here in the car, and they were talking about our agriculture and our ag business in America and how it's a big business and how they're getting these huge huge subsidies. I mean, you know, billions of dollars goes to, you know, very, you know, wealthy farmers. And really, it's just a hand, huh? Yeah, mostly to the wealthy farmers, the big farmers. You know, just a handful, really. And how come? How come it doesn't, how come? There's only one reason. Now, what are we talking about? We're talking about rent seeking. What is rent seeking? Why do the wealthy farmers get mostly subsidies? Because they have a strong lobby machine in Washington, D.C. They have put millions of dollars into influencing politicians, you see, and that's what rent seeking is. I mean, let's say you own a business and you've got $1 million, and you say, okay, now, should I put this $1 million into making a better product, or should I put this $1 million into Washington, D.C. to influence legislation that would benefit my business? Now, which way is $1 million better spent for you? And you might decide, hey, I got a whole lot more to gain by putting this $1 million, you know, into this lobby machine in you know, Washington, D.C. than I do making a better product. I mean, the only reason that especially if you look at the agriculture, that, you know, certain farmers are big wealthy farmers are getting almost all of the subsidies is because, you know, rent seeking. They put millions of dollars in the influence and legislation to benefit themselves. You know, one thing that's really concerned me is I've been reading a lot lately of how, you know, we're not only faced with an economic crisis, but we're faced with a food crisis. And there are riots all over the world because of high food prices. And even here in America, people are starting to hoard food because, it's becoming more apparent that we have a shortage. Now, the point I'm making is that up until the 1990s, it was a government policy to have a year's supply of certain grains in storage, so that if a catastrophe happened, then we would have this food in reserve. Now, do we have that today? No, we don't have 1 ounce of food in reserve. And how come? And this is really all about rent seeking. How come? Because where is the lobby, where is the special interest group behind having, you know, a storage of grains? Doesn't exist, right? There is no lobby that will push that kind of legislation in D.C. But there are other groups that, you know, are, you see what I mean? So laws are passed, not necessarily what's best for the nation, but, you know, where's the money coming from? And so anyway, this is what rent seeking is. I mean, it's an actual term, and it does go on. Well, let's go to the next chapter here. I spent most of my time on chapter 29. Chapter 33 is on international finance. What determines the value of a major currency on the world market, like the American dollar? The market, right? And the market is what? Demand and supply. Demand for what? Well, demand for the dollar. Now, why do people demand dollars? Yeah, to buy goods and services that we produce here in this country. Right? Why do people demand euros to buy goods and services that are produced in those European countries? So that's the demand for these currencies. Now, this is what is called a freely flexible international exchange rate system. We have what is called a freely flexible international exchange rate system where currencies are determined, major currencies. Now, there are some minor currencies that may be pegged to a major currency. There's some currencies around the world that's pegged to the dollar, and there's other currencies that are pegged, you know, to the euro. But if you're talking about major currencies, then, you know, most of them, I say most of them because I don't think this is true, like, for the Chinese currency. And they're certainly becoming, a world, player economically. But, you know, most major currencies, the values of those currencies are simply determined by market forces. Why did Congress in 1932 decrease the money supply?
They were hoping for more.
Now, how are we going to get more foreign investors? By decreasing the money supply. Yes. See, you decrease the money supply, you increase interest rates. When you increase interest rates, then this may attract foreign money, or at least maybe prevent foreigners from taking money out of the country, which was really more the case, like, you know, maybe 1932. And so that's what interest rates. Now, what is one criticism of our present chairman of the Federal Reserve, of Bernanke? I mean, what do some people say? Hey, you made a major mistake because the dollar has fallen so much in value, and that's causing all kinds of problems. Criticism is that Bernanke, now I'm not saying this is, you know, factual or right or wrong, but what I'm saying is that there's some criticism against his policies over the past couple of years by keeping interest rates much lower than maybe they should have been. Well, what's wrong with keeping interest rates low? Of course, there's a reason for it, right? Keep interest rates low, encourage economic growth, encourage people to borrow, buy cars, buy houses, right? But what we're talking about is the international picture, right? Now, when we keep interest rates artificially low, especially relative to other countries, what's going to happen to the demand for the dollar? It's going to go down. And if the demand goes down because our interest rates are lower, I mean, see, what's one reason why people demand dollars? Well, they demand dollars so they can buy maybe government securities. Why? To earn interest. But if they can get a better interest somewhere else, especially if you consider these other factors, then they'll go do that. And so by keeping our interest rates, you know, very low, it's led to it's a factor anyway in the run on the American dollar internationally, which has led to a big decline in the value. Of course, now when the value goes down, you know, you've got overall implications, but you got winners and you got losers too, right? Who are the winners in terms of the fall in the value of the dollar? Now, again, we're talking about the international market here, right? So who are the winners? What group gains every time the dollar falls in value?
People who are exporting.
Exactly right. People who are exporting. If you own a business and a big part of your business is being exported, then you gain from the fall in the value of the dollar. Because foreigners' buying power increases, right? I mean, if the dollar falls in value relative to their currency, they can buy more. American goods now are less expensive. So if you're exporting, that's good news for you. Now, of course, who loses? Well, the opposite people loses, right? People who are importing lose. Because now that means foreign products are more expensive. So, you know, so much of this, you know, you got winners and you got losers. Now, if you look at the total picture, the fall in the value of the dollar has led to many things that are negative for the United States. What's one reason why we're paying $3.50 for a gallon of gasoline? Yeah, the value of the dollar. When we take the dollar and we go, you know, to these foreign countries, you know, like Saudi Arabia, and we say we want to buy oil. Well, the dollar, you know, if the it doesn't have much buying power. It's so low in value relative to, you know, other currencies. So that oil, you know, becomes much more expensive to us. You see how all these things are related? You know, you got to see how things are related here. And that, you know, we certainly live in a global world. Okay, I'm almost done with this. Time is running out here. What?
There's somebody in the hallway.
Oh, somebody in the hallway. Boy, I tell you, you know, this audio is so sensitive. Now, what we say is that in our present system, we allow major currencies to float. Now, what does that mean, to float? Well, that means that, you know, we're going to, you know, the value is going to be determined by market forces. But now, what is a dirty float? What is a dirty float? What does that term mean? Yeah, influence. You know, we're going to, okay, we're going to let the value of major currencies be determined by market forces, but we're going to influence those market forces. And that's called a dirty float. And that's what we've got. That's the system that we've got today. Yes, currencies are, you know, major currencies are determined by market forces, but there are several things that we can do that would influence those market forces. Now, not control by any means. You know, the world is too big for us to control these things, but we can nudge it one way or the other. You know, there's several ways we can do it, you know. I mean, big, you know, national banks can take actions, you know, in terms of exchanging currencies around the world. I mean, you know, anytime we are the International Monetary Fund, I mean, anytime we go to the International Monetary Fund and borrow money in, let's say, foreign currencies and then take those foreign currencies around the world and exchange them for dollars, what's happening to the demand for the dollar? It goes up. We're influencing market forces. Now, can we borrow as much money, or can banks take enough action to control the value of the dollar? Well, no. I mean, you know, I mean, we can't. We're not that. You know, the world is too big for us to do that. But we can nudge it one way or the other. You know, we can influence those market forces. So you might call this a dirty float. We have what is called a managed system. You know, it's a pretty flexible international monetary system, but we can manage it up to a certain point. Okay? Okay, well, I think I just about covered, you know, the basics of this. You know, this does complete the review here for chapters 29 and 33.